Today is April 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Mario Ritter Jr. in Washington. Coming up, Rwanda marks the 25th anniversary of the genocide that took the lives of hundreds of thousands.
They, as the youth, as the majority in this country, can help prevent any form of genocide like the one that happened in Rwanda.
And also ahead, we talk to a reporter covering a crackdown on Nigerian human traffickers operating in Italy, the latest on Britain's attempt to reach a deal on exiting the European Union, and we talk to a policy expert on the world's economy. It's all on today's International Edition. Our top story today, Rwanda's President Paul Kagame on Sunday led commemorations marking the 25th anniversary of the genocide that killed hundreds of thousands of people. In 1994, more than 800,000 people, mostly ethnic Tutsis, died when members of the Hutu majority attacked them. 3 years of civil war had preceded the genocide. Kagame, who led the Rwandan Patriotic Front, a militia made up largely of Tutsis, who had been in exile in Uganda since the 1950s, had battled his way into the country. A peace deal was signed in 1993, but there was resistance to it, and when a plane carrying the Rwandan and Burundian presidents was shot down on April 6, 1994, it set off what has been called a well-organized, systematic slaughter of Tutsis. Thousands of Hutus also died, as well as members of the country's indigenous community known as the Twa. Today, Rwanda has focused on reconciliation and national unity. VOA's Edward Ruima is in Kigali to report on the commemoration events. He spoke with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson about the events today.
The day began at Kigali Genocide Memorial, where President Kagame and other heads of states who accompanied him went to pay respect to the victims of the Rwandan genocide. Kigali Genocide Memorial is home now to 250,000 victims who are buried there. At the same time, they also lit a flame that will be burning for the next 100 days, signifying the 100 days of the killings in April 1994, from April 1994 to July of 1994. Then from there, they proceeded to Kigali Convention Center. That's where the speeches were given. President Kagame, who was the keynote speaker, he spoke about different issues. He spoke about the survivors and the sacrifice they make in being resilient and also being able to forgive. There were several other speakers, for example, the Prime Minister of Belgium, whose country lost 10 peacekeepers here in Rwanda, but he also admitted a certain role that he thinks the Belgium government did not fulfill. That's the role of protecting civilians when they were badly in need. So he said the international community was to blame for ignoring Rwanda at the time of need.
As you mentioned, there are 100 days worth of events. What are some of the other events that will be held during this period?
Well, most of the events regard, for example, burying the remains, because as people start talking about the genocide, as some of the perpetrators or the killers complete their terms in prison, there's so much information that comes with that. So most of the time they will come and reveal where they killed and buried the victims, and then the victims' families will go and then dig and get those remains and bury them. So most of the time those remains are kept and then buried throughout the 100 days. And then there's also, holding conferences to discuss, reflect, and remember. talking to youth, visiting genocide survivors, constructing houses to those in need that were left without anything.
Now, you mentioned the youth. I understand that three quarters of the population is quite young, and that 60% of the youth were born post-genocide. How does the government, how do communities connect the youth to this legacy, and how do the youth respond?
Most of the youth I've spoken to, especially those that were born after 1994, most of them think that it's time now to focus more on the future of Rwanda, their own future, rather than being dragged by what happened in 1994 when they were not here. But at the same time, there's also a sense of urgency, a sense of trying to explain and teach these kids what exactly took place so that they, as the youth, as the majority in this country, can help prevent any form of genocide like the one that happened in Rwanda. But at the same time, we also heard of other youth who are ignorant about exactly what happened, either to their families, because some of the families are not ready to open up about what exactly happened. Some probably took part in the genocide, and they think it's a shame for them to be explaining to their kids what exactly happened. But again, you find another problem where those youth who are willing to open up are also being dragged by the fact that their parents, they are being associated with what their parents.
That was Edward Rima with VOA's Central Africa Service. He was speaking with Kate Pound Dawson. The U.S. military said Sunday that it has moved most of its forces in Libya out of the country because of worsening security situation there. The Africa Command said its troops in Libya support diplomatic missions, counter-terrorism operations, and regional security activities. The announcement came after the United Nations appealed for a two-hour truce in the suburbs of Tripoli to evacuate civilians and those wounded as forces loyal to military commander General Khalifa Haftar continue a push aimed at taking the capital. Libya's UN-backed Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj calls Haftar's troop movement an attempted coup. As the fighting spread, U.S. Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the UN would never give up its support for the Libyan people. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi called on the international community to take action to restore stability to the Libyan capital. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov was in Cairo Saturday and urged all parties to stop fighting and start negotiating. In Italy, police are cracking down on Nigerian crime gangs in Palermo, the Sicilian capital. In a major operation last week, the police arrested several members of one gang implicated in human trafficking and forced prostitution. Josephine McKenna is a journalist in Rome covering the story. She tells my colleague Kate Pound Dawson that Nigerian crime gangs have proliferated in Italy in recent years.
We are seeing slower economic growth in some major economies such as China and in Europe generally, and that plays a huge role in the direction of trade. But for the United States, trade continues to grow pretty robustly on both the export and the import side. And I think the forecasts for the United States continue to be pretty positive. There are some concerns about trade policy, though, that could affect this. So the U.S.-China tariffs have been a negative that have produced a drag on a variety of U.S. exports as well as imports from China. The Institute for International Finance had a study where they showed that in affected U.S. exports, including about 900 product categories that U.S. exports had fallen dramatically. And these are goods that were subjected to retaliatory tariffs by China. Seeing those kinds of tariffs put in place and persist is very concerning to the business community. We have been hearing positive signs about the direction of the negotiations, but nothing's agreed until everything's agreed, and so we'll be watching that.
How would Brexit affect the U.S., particularly if it's what they call the hard Brexit, without any sort of phased transition or trade agreements or anything like that?
Right. That's a good question. U.S. companies have invested more than $700 billion in the United Kingdom and employ more than 1.4 million people in the United Kingdom. So we're stakeholders in the British economy. Those investments were made. They were predicated on the idea that those facilities would be able to sell the goods and services that they produce, not just to the British people, but to others in the European Union. And so the terms of Britain's exit from the EU matter a great deal to those companies. A no-deal Brexit is something that we have argued vociferously against. There are a wide array of studies and forecasts that show that it would be extremely disruptive to the British economy. It would cost anywhere from 4 to 9% of their GDP, according to different studies.
Now, are there other concerns for the chamber as far as trade, the strong U.S. dollar, the relationship with Mexico and Central America, the progress in Congress of the new updated trade agreement with Canada and Mexico?
Well, all of those. On the USMCA, we're strong supporters of that agreement, and we're urging Congress to approve it. And from the perspective of the U.S. business community, it will preserve and strengthen our strong trade ties to Canada and Mexico. These are by far our two largest export markets. Canada and Mexico buy more U.S.-made manufactured goods than the next 11 countries on the list. We need to maintain our access to those markets, and this agreement will do that, and it will also modernize the terms of trade. And we think it's a good deal, and it was negotiated in a way to have bipartisan appeal, so we're hopeful that we'll see action on it here this summer. One other issue that I'll just mention, the president has received a report from the Commerce Department with recommendations on whether to impose tariffs on imported automobiles and auto parts. I mentioned this briefly before. That's an area of real concern. There's a saying in the auto industry that every state is an auto state because the footprint of this, our largest manufacturing sector, touches the whole country. It's a sector that's been prospering. Output has doubled in the past decade. So it's a sector that's doing well. But imposing these tariffs is something that's opposed universally by U.S. nameplate or foreign nameplate manufacturers, as well as part manufacturers, dealers. And so we're pushing the administration not to follow through on that threat.
Our apologies. That was John Murphy, the Senior Vice President for International Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in Washington. He spoke to Kate Pound Dawson about business advocacy and the need to keep a close eye on economic developments worldwide to avoid a worldwide slowdown. Among the top stories in the world today, Ugandan security forces have rescued an American woman and her driver who were kidnapped by gunmen in Queen Elizabeth National Park. Pakistan has called on the international community to prevent India from launching another attack on its territory. And Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has established a new leadership council in an effort to put together a team able to reach peace talks with the Taliban. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on voanews.com's website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Thank you. We rejoin the story about Italian police cracking down on Nigerian crime gangs in Palermo, the Sicilian capital. Josephine McKenna is a journalist in Rome, and she is covering the story. She spoke with Kate Pound Dawson earlier.
Well, Italian police have claimed to have smashed a Nigerian crime ring operating in the Sicilian capital, Palermo. They have arrested seven people and issued arrest warrants for six. Now, police swooped on members of the Nigerian mafia. They say are operating in Palermo in an operation dubbed No Fly Zone. And their target was members of the I-Gang, E-I-Y-E gang, one of several Nigerian gangs operating in Italy. And this gang is alleged to have been operating in drug trafficking, prostitution, and also using violence and intimidation to extend their operations. And there's also some fierce rivalry going on here between other Nigerian gangs, including the Black Axe and another one called Arubaga.
All right. Now, what comes next in this investigation?
Well, police are working very closely with local prosecutors, and they will be looking to interrogate those that they have arrested in order to try and recover those who might be on the run who they haven't been able to capture, but also to understand more about how these gangs operate in Sicily. We know that they are very embedded with the Italian mafia gangs, the Cosa Nostra in Sicily and Ndrangheta in Calabria. So these are operating in conjunction with the other Italian mafia. But there's also concern from investigators that there is a cult element to these gangs because they had evidence that some members had to undergo certain rituals in order to be accepted into the gangs as members.
Now, how large of a problem are these Nigerian crime gangs or other crime gangs that originated from outside Italy?
Well, there's no doubt that the Nigerian crime gangs have proliferated in Italy in recent years. They control an extensive network of prostitutes and often order them on demand from Nigeria. Now, there has been some disruption because the Italian government has been working very hard to block the migrant ships arriving from Libya and other parts of North Africa. But there's no doubt from investigators that these gangs are entrenched with the Italian mafia in a very structured way where they carve up the territory or work in tandem with the Italian mafia gangs in terms of drug trafficking and running prostitution rackets. There's also plenty of violence, including knife crime and other forms of violence and intimidation going on here.
The White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney on Sunday said the opposition Democrats will not see President Donald Trump's tax returns as the confrontation over the president's taxes ramps up. Last week, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Democratic Representative Richard Neal, asked the Internal Revenue Service for Trump's personal and business returns over the past 6 years. He made the request under a law that allows Congress to view the tax records of any individual. The Associated Press's Ben Thomas has more.
Oh, no, never.
Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney told Fox News Sunday American voters decided they didn't need to see President Trump's tax returns.
They elected him anyway, which, of course, is what drives the Democrats crazy.
But Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee, a member of the House Ways and Means Committee, tells ABC's This Week the president's continuing control of his wealth demands scrutiny.
The public has a right to know whether their president's interests are impacting the decisions that he makes.
Appearing on NBC's Meet the Press, Senator Mitt Romney says he thinks President Trump should make good on his promise to release his tax returns, but Democrats' demands are just playing into his hands.
Going after his tax returns through a legislative action is moronic. That's not going to happen. The courts are not going to say that you can compel a person running for office to release their tax returns.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
The head of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Christian Nielsen, resigned Sunday evening after a meeting with President Donald Trump. The president announced the resignation by Twitter and thanked Nielsen for her service. He said the head of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection will become acting DHS secretary. News reports say Nielsen had come under fire from the president, who had been angered by the rise in the number of Central American migrants seeking asylum at the border with Mexico. Human rights activists and members of the opposition Democratic Party had criticized her for implementing several Trump policies, including separating migrant parents from their children at the border. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he will annex some Israeli settlements in the West Bank if he wins Tuesday's Israeli election. The move would mark a sharp departure from current Israeli policy. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
In an interview with Israeli television, Benjamin Netanyahu promised to annex at least some Jewish settlements in the West Bank. He said that every Jewish settlement in the West Bank is part of Israel, and he will not uproot one Jewish settler. That is in contrast to his challenger, Benny Gantz, who has said he could move some Israelis from the West Bank in a peace deal with the Palestinians. Netanyahu's remarks come 2 days before a closely fought Israeli election that could challenge Netanyahu's 10-year run in the prime minister's office. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad Malki warned that Netanyahu would face a real problem if he annexes Jewish settlements. Palestinians say the entire West Bank and Gaza Strip, as well as East Jerusalem, must be part of a future Palestinian state. Israel has controlled the West Bank since 1967, but unlike the Golan Heights or East Jerusalem, has never annexed it. About 400,000 Israelis live in Jewish settlements in the West Bank, alongside 2.3 million Palestinians. U.S. President Donald Trump has promised to release details of a new peace plan after the Israeli election. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
British Prime Minister Theresa May says she is willing to reach out to the Labour Party to gain support for a deal with the European Union on Britain's withdrawal from the bloc. May released a video on social media Sunday in which she said that the two main parties must work together in order to reach an agreement that protects Britain's interests. May has failed 3 times to get a deal on exiting the EU passed in Parliament. Now, some in her own party are dissatisfied with her reaching out to Labour leaders. Jacob Mees-Mogg is a Conservative member, party member, who spoke with AP's Karen Chamas.
The Prime Minister has acknowledged there is little chance of winning a new vote and warned that without help from the opposition, Brexit could slip through our fingers. But leading Conservative Brexiteer Jacob Rees-Mogg slammed May's move to include Labour in the Brexit talks and blamed her for failing to take Britain out of the EU already.
There is an irony at the very minimum of saying 1 week that one thinks Mr Corbyn is dangerous and unfit for office, and the next week deciding to cohabit with him.
With the UK once again days away from a deadline for leaving the European Union, 3 days of cross-party talks so far have ended with no agreement. Karen Chamas, London.
Britain currently faces a deadline to leave the EU of April 12th. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Next up, Attorney General William Barr has promised to release a redacted version of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russia's interference in the U.S. presidential election by mid-April. But will that satisfy Democrats and the U.S. public? Analysts John Fortier and Jim Kessler spar over that and more on the Politics edition of Encounter, Saturday and Sunday, on The Voice of America.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and scientists warn of a growing number of patients in Venezuela who are in need of vaccine-preventable diseases like measles, diphtheria, and polio. One of the main hospitals in the Colombia-Venezuela border says it is seeing more people who need treatment. Cristina Caicemo-Schmidt has the story.
The Pan American Health Organization reports there were 886 measles cases in 2018 in Venezuela and more than 159 already this year. Dr. Anthony Fauci with the U.S. National Institutes of Health says Venezuela hadn't seen measles and diphtheria for more than 20 years before the diseases reemerged in 2017.
This is a typical and classical example of what happens when you have a deterioration of the healthcare infrastructure, which is exactly what's unfortunately going on in Venezuela.
Experts say when immunizations aren't kept up, long-forgotten diseases can make a comeback. World Health Organization spokesman Tarik Jesarevic says a rapid response is needed to contain highly contagious diseases like measles.
So any community that does not reach a sufficient level of vaccination among children is at risk of developing an outbreak of a certain disease.
According to a report by the Centers for Disease Control, nearly 70% of all measles cases are Venezuelans. The Erasmo Mills University Hospital in Cúcuta, Colombia, is one of the main health care centers in the country that admits large numbers of Venezuelan patients.
Of measles, we had one case in 2015 and in 2017. In 2018, we registered 28 cases of measles of Venezuelan patients.
Jaime says more Venezuelans are coming to the emergency room for treatment. The number of ER patients a day has nearly doubled this year.
If someone is sick and requires hospitalization, we cannot tell him we're full, come back another day. This is the crisis. We're experimenting.
The Pan American Health Organization confirms that 8,000 children received measles vaccines in Venezuela last year, but scientists in the U.S. are still concerned that due to Venezuela's weak health infrastructure, viruses and other pathogens will continue to cross borders, especially as more people leave the country. Cristina Quecedo-Smith, VOA News, Washington.
The well-reviewed, relatively modestly budgeted Shazam debuted with $53.5 million in ticket sales over the weekend, according to studio estimates Sunday. The latest movie, based on a DC comic superhero stable, Shazam, came out well ahead of the weekend's other top draw, Pet Sematary. Paramount Pictures' remake of the original 1989 Stephen King adaptation opened in a distant second at $25 million. You have been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com and like us on Facebook. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr. in Washington. Be sure to enjoy your day.
This is